Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. This is going to sound more existential than economic, but bear with me here. Forever, it turns out, is a very, very long time. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, the 22nd of August. Glad, as always, to have you along, everybody. There is a word that now comes attached to the war in Afghanistan, an extrapolation of sorts from President Trump's speech last night. The president didn't specify troop levels or a new strategy. He did say, though, that there won't be any artificial timetables or deadlines for getting Americans out of Afghanistan, saying instead that that is going to be decided by conditions on the ground. And that means 16 years into it, that Afghanistan has officially become a generational war. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson digs into the political economics of open-ended military commitments.
The U.S. has maintained long-term military forces in countries before. Take Germany, Japan, or South Korea. But how much help is history in determining what an open-ended commitment looks like? Phil Gordon is with the Council on Foreign Relations.
The difference is obviously that those are allies of the United States that are extraordinarily stable. And the troop presence there is one of deterrence to prevent a war from taking place, not to win a war that is actually going on.
The high levels of violence and poverty in Afghanistan put it in a special category. So it's hard to predict what the cost of U.S. engagement there will be. David Johnson is a retired Army colonel, now with the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments.
So the question to me is, you know, what number of forces would it take to train the Afghan army? What kind of enablers, you know, drones, special forces, air power, will it take to keep the Taliban disrupted?
By October, the U.S. Defense Department alone will have committed to spend somewhere around $840 billion in Afghanistan, says Anthony Cordesman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
I think the cost of the added troops, and we don't know the numbers or details, will be about $2 to $4 billion a year in terms of their train, assist, and enable mission. But it's very hard to break out the costs.
He says those costs could spike suddenly with any unexpected territorial losses. We know from Syria and Iraq that it's much harder and more expensive to recover ground than it is to protect it. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There's a little bit of federal spending news to pass on, little here being in relative terms. The Interior Department says it's going to end a $1 million study into the health risks from what's known as mountaintop removal coal mining, kind of mining that dumps debris down into surrounding valleys. The study was looking at the connection between that mining waste and health problems for the people living in those valleys and nearby, things like heart disease and lung and cancer and birth defects. Marketplace's Jed Kim makes the connection between research money and regulatory policy.
Does mountaintop removal harm public health? Michael Hendricks at Indiana University has been researching this for a decade.
I think we know more than we need to know that this process is harmful and should be stopped now.
He says we don't know the exact ways or levels at which it causes harm. That's part of what the National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine was looking into. Now it won't. John Cookett is with the Sierra Club. He says stopping the science is in line with the Trump administration's goals of bringing back coal jobs to Appalachia.
If they move forward and the National Academy finds that mountaintop removal impacts the health of the communities that live around these mines, then That will be used as the justification for establishing public health standards.
Standards that, once in place, would have to be upheld and would mean messier fights down the road for coal companies.
Not moving forward with studies, not moving forward with initiatives, it's actually the easiest thing they can do.
The National Mining Association said it couldn't provide anyone for an interview. In a statement, it said there isn't a definitive link between mountain removal and health effects. But that's a bit of a chicken and egg problem, says John Deskins. He directs the Bureau of Business and Economic Research at West Virginia University.
If we don't do research on it, then there's certainly not ever going to be a proven link. I mean, that's how come you have to do research.
The Sierra Club says funding could come from other sources, but if it's not a federally backed study, the government may not have to abide by the results. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today. I'm going to oversimplify just a hair, but here is basically what happened. Politico published a story this morning on which the headline read, "Trump's team and lawmakers making strides on tax reform plan." Boom. Rally. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Last week, the CEO of an important but generally not all that well-known technology company sent an all-staff email. Not the newsiest of items, I know, but for the fact that this email was a little bit different. It read in part, "Earlier today, Cloudflare terminated the account of the Daily Stormer. It was a decision I could make," he said, "because I'm the CEO of a major internet infrastructure company. No one should have that power." The CEO in question is Matthew Prince. The Daily Stormer is a neo-Nazi and white supremacist website. Cloudflare, we should say, is an every now and then underwriter of this program. And we are talking about all of this, of course, because of Charlottesville and Matthew Prince's decision to do what he did. Matthew Prince, thanks for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
Why'd you do this?
So Cloudflare has about 10% of all internet requests flowing through us. And we have traditionally tried to be neutral, not using our own morals to choose who is and who is not online. The challenge was with this website, the Daily Stormer, that they, at the end of the day, were just jerks. They did some things that were violating our policies and creating an enormous distraction for us. And ultimately, last week, I made a call to say that it just wasn't worth keeping them on our network and keeping them online.
I wonder, though, if rather than taking them offline, there was another way to deal with this instead of, as you said in your blog posts, waking up one morning and being in a bad mood and throwing them off.
Yeah, I think that's something that I've worried about for the last week. It's really a deep concern if you have infrastructure companies making choices about who can and cannot be on the internet. I would sort of analogize it to the telephone company listening in on your phone calls and deciding that they don't like what you're talking about, so they turn you off. Our challenge was that we'd been trying to have a conversation about who should be regulating and effectively censoring the internet, and yet the question just kept coming back to, why do you support Nazis? Obviously, we don't support Nazis. The content was repugnant, but I do think it's really important for us to have a conversation about who and when and where and how the internet will get regulated and will get censored.
Since I have you on the phone and since you brought it up and since you are the guy who unilaterally did regulate the internet in this case, who do you think ought to be doing it? Should you guys be a utility and public utility commissions and hearings and all that?
That's probably above my pay grade to
tell
you
exactly. No, you run
the
company. Come on.
Sure, I run the company, but I don't run the internet.
In this instance.
That's right. And I think what we need to talk about is that you should be able to know what the rules are when you participate in a system. You should have transparency. There should be accountability. And I worry that if the people deciding what can and cannot be on the internet are a group of tech executives like myself, that we inherently can't follow principles of due process. Again, I'm not sure who the right person is, but I do think that there needs to be some aspect of rule of law, and I'm not sure that we followed that when we made the decision we did last week.
Let's say the ACLU does something you vehemently disagree with. And in fact, they start saying that Cloudflare supports whatever that action is. You going to shut them down?
Again, what I hope comes out of this is an understanding that there's a real risk and a real danger of infrastructure companies like Cloudflare being the internet police. And we had tried to hold that policy for a long time, but that policy was a policy that we came up with, you know, as a small team. Now we've had a debate and a public discussion. I get to talk to you about this, and I love that you're holding my feet to the fire on this. And my hope is that what comes out of this is a policy which has more legitimacy because it's come out of a public discussion and not simply been something that Cloudflare decided in and of itself, which is a really good way of me not answering your question.
You know, I hold your feet to the fire and you decline to answer. That's fine. Where does this go then? I mean, you have amplified this issue in a way that has gotten you notice, has gotten the company notice, but also in theory has gotten the issue notice. Now what happens?
I think that there are a number of stakeholders. Google, for instance, made the call 2 days before we did that they would not allow this particular website, the Daily Stormer website, to use their registrar service, which is a service that allows you to purchase domains. But Google runs a lot of other services as well, and they didn't block the Daily Stormer from any of those things.
Yet.
They could have.
Right? I mean, there's a yet that has to be said there. If Sergey Brin and Larry Page wake up in the same bad mood that you woke up in that morning, then they can do whatever they want.
That, I think, is why we need to be having this conversation. And there are stakeholders that aren't just technology companies. They're regulators, law enforcement, civil society organizations, content creators, content consumers. Any one of them can be making editorial decisions about what is and is not allowed online. And we need a social contract as to who can and can't do that. And that needs to be transparent.
Matthew Prince, co-founder and CEO of Cloudflare. Matthew, thanks a lot for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Today in Brexit means Brexit until it becomes inconvenient and or costs you money. The British farmer. Ag over there has a lot on the line should or when, I guess, Britain leaves the European Union. Anecdotal evidence suggests that a whole lot of English farmers voted for Brexit amid complaints about excessive European regulation and waste at EU headquarters over in Brussels. But with the end of EU subsidies in sight and a much talked about trade deal with the United States possibly taking a bite out of their income, things are looking different down on the farm. From Dorset in Western England Marketplaces, Stephen Beard has that one.
Any British farmer who voted for Brexit must now regret it, says vocal anti-Brexiteer Polly Toynbee, a columnist for The Guardian newspaper.
I think a lot of farmers are suddenly realising what it means. They lose their subsidy, and if there is this big importing of cheaper food, they really get wiped out. This is a big dilemma.
At the annual Gillingham and Shaftesbury Farm Show in rural Western England, the brass band plays a defiant American march, Death or Glory. But some of the farmers exhibiting here are apprehensive. Are you nervous about Brexit?
Well, bound to be, because it's the unknown. We don't know. It's like a divorce. You don't know what's going to happen, really. It's just the unknown. We shall see.
Pat Apsley is exhibiting some of the sheep he rears on his small family farm of 100 acres. To keep the farm going, he drives a cab in the evenings and weekends. He's worried that Brexit will bring an end to EU subsidies.
If I haven't got that, I'm finished.
You couldn't farm without subsidies?
Couldn't farm without it, no, definitely not.
EU farm subsidies for the UK amount to $3.8 billion a year and make up more than half the total of all farm income in Britain. The government says payments will continue for at least 3 years after Brexit, but the longer-term future of farm subsidies here must be uncertain. So why would a farmer vote to leave the EU?
Did you vote for Brexit?
I didn't, be honest.
Because a lot of farmers did vote for Brexit, didn't they?
Yeah.
It was a bit like turkeys voting for Christmas.
Well, yes, but I don't think everybody thought it was going to go that way. It was a bit of a shock to the system.
None of the farmers I met here admitted voting for Brexit, but many worry about another possibility, a free trade deal with the US. That might bring into Britain cheaper meat produced using American practices currently banned in the UK on animal welfare grounds. like feeding cattle with growth promoters. Cattle farmer Neil Hutchins doesn't approve.
They cheat, don't they? They feed them steroids and that kind of thing, and they get bigger and quicker meat. We'd have to do the same.
Hutchins fears that competition from cheap, hormone-treated beef from the US would eventually drive British farmers to adopt the same intensive rearing pens as their American counterparts.
Not for me, but if you can make more money by having them in a shed, that's what's going to happen.
Hardline Brexiters say a free trade deal with the US is essential. And anyway, it's up to British consumers whether they want hormone-treated beef or chicken rinsed in chlorine to kill the bacteria. Judging by these consumers at the show, Kate Crabb and May McGrouther, British farmers have nothing to fear. They're not tempted by the American fare.
Absolutely not. I think it just feels wrong to eat something that's washed in chlorine.
You bathe in swimming pools, don't you, that have got chlorine in them, and I don't like doing that, so I certainly don't want my chicken washed in chlorine.
But American produce could be a juicy 20% cheaper than the British variety. Many other consumers might be tempted, and that, says McGrouther, would be unfair on British farmers.
If we won't accept our farmers doing it, then we shouldn't accept anything into the country that other farmers are prepared to do. It's not a fair trade agreement, then.
Whether they'll have to compete with American produce and lose their subsidies, whether they voted for Brexit or not, Britain's farmers face a very uncertain future. In Western England, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up,
all the different road users should pay their fair share.
Bicycle riders, he is talking to you. First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, so I'll tell you what, you dangle a little tax reform in front of traders. Here you go. Dow up 196 points today, 0.9%, 21,899. Or the NASDAQ up 84 points, about 1.3%, 6297. The S&P 500 added 24.9%, 24.52. Macy's has hired a new president, a veteran of e-commerce site eBay. Theory being, if you can't beat him, join him, I suppose. Macy's stock up 4.5% today. eBay delivered about 1.6%. While you're being distracted by current events, the price of metals has been climbing. Thank you very much. Copper hit a three-year high today. Good news for copper producer Freeport-McMoRan, up 2.3% today. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose to 2.21%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We turn now to the documented effects of popular culture on the business world, specifically tourism. Game of Thrones is your thing? There are tours of Dubrovnik, Croatia to meet your needs. In New Zealand, Hobbit Village, where Lord of the Rings was shot, is waiting for you. The question today, though, is whether this song can do the same thing for Puerto Rico. Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído, para que te acuerdes si no estás. Despacito, in case you didn't know, by Puerto Rican recording artists Luis Fonsi and Daddy Yankee, the video of which has, hang on to your hats here, a record 3.3 billion views on YouTube as of today. Matt Gross wrote about the Puerto Rican tourism economy and Despacito on Bloomberg. Welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
So what do we know about this omnipresent song and tourism in Puerto Rico?
It's obviously an incredibly popular song, but is it popular enough to send people across the waves over to Puerto Rico? That's a little bit harder to measure.
What kind of things do people look at? I mean, I'm sure the Puerto Rican Tourism Bureau has numbers on this.
Oh, well, they do and they don't. What the Puerto Rican Tourism Board is really excited about right now is that search queries are up. You look at hotels.com and Orbitz and cheap tickets, Expedia. Everybody is searching for Puerto Rico. Numbers are up 45%, 17%, 24%. But that's search queries. That's not the same thing as actually buying a ticket, booking a hotel, going to Puerto Rico and spending money there.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, right? So I talked about New Zealand and Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones and Ireland. Those actually did translate. I wonder how much a song is going to make you want to go to Puerto Rico.
I think if you're inclined to go to Puerto Rico already, the fact that there's this incredibly popular song with a video filled with incredibly hot people dancing in colorful seaside locations, that's maybe going to push you over the edge and you're definitely going to go. But whether it's gathering up all these new people who'd never heard of Puerto Rico before and sending them, you know, on these trips, that's a much trickier thing to do.
Well, let me throw a dirty word or two in here that might explain why it won't translate. And those two words are Justin Bieber.
please. This is a family radio show.
That's right. His name is part of the success of this song.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He did this remix. It's one of the, I believe, the most viewed or most streamed song of all time. And his embrace of the song and his popularity may very well translate into people going to Puerto Rico. But you got to think, I mean, he's got an audience of hundreds of millions of people.
Yeah.
He says, you know, through the song, go to Puerto Rico. Some infinitesimal percent of those people may actually go to Puerto Rico. It's a great little rounding error and it's going to make some money for the island. But is that generating a huge wave of visits there? We don't know yet. It's really hard to figure out.
It is something that the island of Puerto Rico could use, right? Because between Zika and the terrible economy and their debt problems, I mean, they've been having a rough go.
Yeah, it's not been too great. And that's actually one of the things that's sort of skewing the numbers a bit, as I think that they've had a rough couple of years. And so, sure, the numbers look up. That's because they've been down.
Yeah. Matt Gross, writing in Bloomberg about Despacito in Puerto Rico. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Despacito, quiero respirar tu cuello despacito. Deja que te diga cosas al oído, para que te acuerdes si no estás conmigo. Despacito, quiero desnudarte a besos despacito.
Sorry about the earworm, gang. All right, so this story now from the Governing Means Making Hard Choices file. Oregon has become the first state in the nation with a special tax on bicycle sales. The state that is sometimes called the most bicycle-friendly in the country now adds $15 to the price of bikes that cost $200 or more. What you think about that depends kind of on where you sit. It's either bad for mom-and-pop cycling shops or good because it shows that bike commuters are a real part of the transportation mix. Oregon Public Broadcasting's Amanda Peacher has the story.
When lawmakers talk about paying for roads, bicycles and cycling infrastructure inevitably come up. Some say cyclists don't pay for roads because they don't pay license or registration fees.
All the different road users should pay their fair share.
That's Bill Mosley, a councilman from the central Oregon city of Bend. In many ways, Oregon's new $15 bike tax is a response to a long and drawn-out battle here between drivers and cyclists.
Cycling uses the roads, and there's nothing wrong with the actual users of the road paying for the infrastructure that they need.
Cycling advocates point out that most bicyclists also pay property taxes or, if they have a car, gas taxes. Both fund roads and bike lanes in Oregon. Jonathan Maas runs a bike advocacy blog called Bike Portland. He argues that if the state wants to reduce traffic congestion and road costs, lawmakers should encourage cycling, not tax it.
We need as many people as possible to choose to ride a bicycle and as few people as possible to choose to drive a car or drive a large truck.
A 2014 study showed that sales in the bicycle industry totaled $440 million in Oregon. Dozens of bike shop owners spoke against taxing bikes while the bill was making its way through the legislature, but some were okay with the $15 tax. Barb Bonebecker is a bike mechanic at Sunnyside Sports. She's hard at work tightening the spokes on a road bike.
Just a tiny bit. It's touching here, so I'll pull it to the other side.
The bike shop is bustling with customers shopping for mountain bikes and people making appointments for tune-ups. Bonebecker sees the tax as a sign that cycling is finally gaining traction.
I feel like we can hold our heads up a little higher when people say we don't contribute.
Bonebecker says the tax is small enough that she doesn't believe it will affect sales at the store.
Our bikes, they start around $250, $300, and I think people understand it.
That's true for Ross Judice, who's shopping for a mountain bike at REI on the other side of Bend.
My bike's pretty old and it's kind of falling apart, so it's either fix it or buy a new one.
Judice says he wouldn't mind paying the $15 on top of the cost of his new bike, especially since the tax will exclusively fund bicycle and pedestrian transportation projects.
In those circumstances, I don't really mind paying a little extra if I'm going to get something back from the government.
Earlier versions of the bill included a 3% sales tax on bikes. That would have added $60 to the cost of a $2,000 bike. As is, the $15 tax is expected to generate $1.2 million. The State Department of Transportation says that's roughly the cost of constructing 5 miles of bike lanes. Cycling advocate Jonathan Maas says this tax could have wider repercussions.
This tax really tarnishes Oregon's reputation. Oregon typically rolls out the red carpet for bicycling, and now the word's going to get out that we want to tax bicycles.
It seems, though, the word has gotten out. A state lawmaker has floated an idea for a similar tax on bikes in Colorado. In Bend, Oregon, I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which we are reminded that there is a market for everything. Breitbart, the once and present home of former White House chief strategist Steve Bannon, has a merchandise section, I learned today, in which they have for sale fidget spinners with Bannon's picture on them, the hashtag war superimposed across the bottom. The sales blurb reads, "Leftists need comfort at times like these. Gift them this pacifying item that will give them something to do in between pulling down monuments." $21.46 for a 3-pack plus tax. All right, here you go. The Dow up 196 today, 0.9%, 21,899. NASDAQ up 84, that's about 1.3%. S&P 500 up 24, 0.9%. Tommy Andres is the producer on a Special Projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on a Wealth and Poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rosdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.